I'll call the case, but go ahead and keep setting yourselves up here. This case is A22-0856, State of Minnesota, respondent versus Chad Edward Danbury, appellant. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments, 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant, if you choose to use it. You know the podium toggles up and down to accommodate your height. And counsel for, if you're all, both ready, counsel for appellant, go ahead. Oh, and of course, please state your name, party represent for the record when you start both of the arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Adam Lozo, and I represent the appellant Chad Danbury. I'd like to begin by addressing an issue that affects two of the claims in this appeal, the district court's finding that the charged offenses arose from a single behavioral incident. But given the number of issues present in the appeal, I'm happy to answer at any time any questions the court has about any of the claims. With regard to the single behavioral incident issue, whether offenses arose from a single behavioral incident is a factual determination that an appellate court does not disturb unless it's shown to be clearly erroneous. Here, the district court judge found that these offenses arose from a single behavioral incident. The state argued for that finding at the district court. The judge at the district court did this by finding that the offenses were committed against the same victim in similar locations for the same criminal purpose, a quintessential single behavioral incident finding.
Isn't the problem there, you really can't do that when you're separated by time, like what
would have been the case in this? Well, before getting to that question, I would respond that the state has not argued, even on appeal, that the finding was clearly erroneous. The state has argued that the finding of the district court should just be disregarded, for the issues raised in parts 2 and part 5 of my brief. So there has been no argument or showing that the finding of the district court was clearly erroneous. And to respond substantively, the factor of time would be one of the factors to balance in the analysis. But simply because the offenses didn't happen simultaneously wouldn't mean that they're necessarily not part of a single behavioral incident. The factors of objective and place, which were both found to support that finding, would also be equally, if not more, relevant.
So the finding that you're referring to, of course, is a finding that was made in a pretrial on a severance motion, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's look at but your argument here is for purposes of sentencing. And I appreciate the argument you're making, state can't have it both ways, that it's, you know, same for joinder as later for sentencing. But bear with me while I ask some questions to try and understand this. Because I think these cases are sort of complicated by discrete acts that make up then multiple acts for a multiple act.
Exactly. Okay. And can I clarify just one thing?
Yes.
So you are correct that one of the issues is a sentencing issue, and then the other issue has to do with whether the state was allowed to add more charges to the complaint later on.
Thank you for that clarification. Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about sentencing. At sentencing, the only acts that were actually adjudicated and sentenced were the discrete acts of criminal sexual conduct. I think the court did not adjudicate or sentence on the multiple acts counts.
That's right? Correct.
Okay. So if we're looking just at sentencing, let's assume for a moment that this is a case where there was no motion to sever at the start. And all we're looking at is the sentencing order and that sentencing decision, and there are, you know, whatever there were at the end, excluding the multiple counts, like 7, 8 counts of the discrete acts, right? What's your argument that there is clear error in sentencing those? Actually, there were four. There were four that were sentenced, right? In the end, only
correct.
Four counts that were sentenced. Why would that be barred by 609.035, considering that we know what those four acts are, which are discrete
So if I'm understanding your hypothetical correctly, my answer would be that it wouldn't be barred by 609.035, because right. In your hypothetical, there's no pretrial severance motion, meaning there's no pretrial finding that they arose from a single behavioral incident.
Okay, so then that gets me to, so if we're looking at the sentencing issue, or even I think adding the other two, statutory double jeopardy issue. I think what you're saying is that that the district court needs to be held to the decision it made pretrial, which included then the multiple counts charges, which were later not adjudicated. That the district court is bound by that state is bound to it. Anyway, under a doctrine of judicial estoppel. It seems to come down to that, which... and my question for you is there a case law? It seems like the Supreme Court has sort of not answered that. It has explicitly said we're not answering whether that. You cite as two civil cases for the proposition that it does apply. But also it just like strikes me as it's just an odd thing, I think, for appellate review that you choose a sentencing argument. Like, for example, if you said, it was clear error to join these and not sever it, them, you might lose on that. I think you put that in a footnote, actually, you sort of challenge it. Well, if they were separate, then they should. But you might lose on harmless error because they probably would come in as Spriegel incidents. So you can see, like, maybe my question, which is inarticulate, but it seems to try and hold the parties to something, pretrial versus sentencing. It seems to limit our review by your choosing sentencing instead of the pretrial to decide whether they're the same. And in a way that, at the end of the day, when we look at what the actual convictions are for, discrete incidents, and there would be nothing contrary to law to sentence those individually, it seems kind of not right.
Well, so my response to that question would be that in this particular situation, so judicial estoppel, which I will certainly get to, is one grounds on which this court should determine that only one sentence could be imposed in this case. But there's another ground, which is simply that the pretrial finding of single behavioral incident was made, and then that was not ever challenged at sentencing. Nobody at sentencing ever argued that a different finding should be made. That was never litigated at sentencing. The finding was made. These are all part of a single behavioral incident, so you can be tried at the same time for all these offenses. And then at sentencing, no one argued, actually, now you should make a different finding. What all we have is the finding that these are a single behavioral incident, and then no contrary finding.
Well, so, I mean, I guess it's an implicit... I mean, if their argument was for, and I was looking for sentencing memos, it looks like the sentencing memos were only done in trial one, that there were not actual sentencing memos at trial three.
Correct,
right?
Your Honor.
Okay, so, because I was trying to see, like, what did they say about this?
Yep.
And I was reading the sentencing transcript about, what are being adjudicated and what wasn't.
Yep.
And it just decided, it doesn't say much about why not adjudicating, but it says lesser included for the two multiple act ones in the sentencing order. I guess I don't know the idea that the state should have come forward and said, you clearly erred at the beginning in the pretrial, and their failure to brief that means that there was not a determination by the court in issuing multiple sentences that they were permissible under 609.035.
Well, my response to that would be that I can tell you what the parties did argue in their sentencing memorandums. The state never argued that these were part of a single or part of separate behavioral incidents. To the contrary, the state said that consecutive sentences could be imposed because it cited a guidelines comment about multiple sentences being permissible even when offenses are part of a single course of conduct. The defense, which to me is not only did the state not argue for something different, the state said, look at this provision of the guidelines that allows multiple sentences to be imposed even in a single course of conduct. The defense responded by saying, there should be one sentence here. It should be count five, which encompasses all of the behavior. And then the court didn't overrule or discuss its pretrial finding at the sentencing hearing.
I mean, was it incumbent upon the district court? Let's say, so this was a pretrial ruling.
Right.
Evidence comes in. And throughout the trial, it sounds like the district court was saying, okay, this incident relates to this. This relates to that count. This other thing relates. So that sounds kind of like separate acts. So was it incumbent upon the judge to say, wait a minute, I made an error in my pretrial ruling. These really are not part of a single behavioral incident. Because he still wouldn't be required to sever, right? I mean, that's the only time you'd say, geez, I made a mistake. I should have severed. I'm going to declare a mistrial.
Well, to clarify, the association of individual acts with individual counts happened pre-trial, happened at the same time as the single behavioral incident finding. So the realization that the state needed to actually allege specific acts corresponding to specific counts happened pre-trial at the same time that the parties were litigating
third,
that severance.
At the third trial.
At the first trial.
At the first... Well, I thought there were conversations throughout kind of trying to figure it.
But well, there were.
That's neither here nor there. Okay.
But the what you're referring to the association of this act matches this count, that happened pretrial at the same time as the severance motion, at the same time the court found that these were part of a single behavioral incident.
Yeah. But
so that didn't happen later.
Counsel, though, I tried a lot of these cases as a trial court judge and as a prosecutor. Very confusing when you're trying to interpret 609.035 and to a certain extent 04 in the context of a case like this where you have one behavioral incident that's multiple acts over a period of time that kind of encompasses the individual counts that you're trying to establish for specific, you know, of those multiple acts. And I guess when I was doing this, we'd always follow the old rule that if it's the same behavioral incident, you generally can only get one consecutive sentence, even if it's multiple victims. But that's kind of in the bank robbery situation, whereas when you're fleeing the bank, you take a shot at a police officer or something, and that's part of the same behavioral incident because it's part of your, you know, desire to get away. But it's a different victim, so we give you a consecutive sentence there. Gets a little more dicey if you want to try to charge assault twos on all the patrons that were in the bank at the time of the robbery. And in that circumstance, you only get, as I understand it, one consecutive sentence, not one for each of the people that were in the bank, in that sort of circumstance. The problem here is, and the way I would have handled it in the old days, because it was my understanding and the understanding I think of the lawyers back then, is you always adjudicate on the charge that is the most serious. And in this case, the charge that is arguably the most serious because of the way it lines up in the guidelines and the like is the multiple acts over a period of time. Nobody makes that argument, so maybe I'm just way behind where the law has gone, but Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. And to be clear, at the trial court level, Mr. Danbury did make that argument. That was one of the arguments he made in his first sentencing, argument, was that because count five encompasses all of these other counts, that's the count that you should sentence on.
The way I would have seen, and I saw this kind of a case play out, is you'd end up oftentimes and with the multiple acts conviction, and then you'd end up with a departure because, you know, it almost always hits some departure because there's usually multiple forms of penetration or multiple forms of contact. So you can get a departure on each charge, and if you sentence then on your one consecutive shot, you can get to whatever number you want to get to. And that's the way we would do it, but I'm troubled by the fact that there was a choice made not to adjudicate the more serious crimes, because that's usually what we do. If somebody's convicted of first and second degree murder, we don't adjudicate second.
Well, and I think that is implicit in the argument about the single behavioral incident, that the only reason these charges were tried together was because that multiple acts charge was included, which was the reason that the judge found that these were all part of a single behavioral incident. So I think it would be absolutely appropriate and consistent with our argument for this court to remand for resentencing only on count five, which is what Mr. Danbury asked for at the district court.
Yeah, you didn't ask for that here. You didn't argue that here.
So,
because I had the same question as Judge Kirk, and then I also have a question for you. The count five, and what did the other count end up being, 10 or 7?
Seven, I think, is what it ended up being, the other multiple acts count.
Yeah, so there are two multiple acts counts. As I understand them, correct me if I'm wrong, count five was for first-degree incidents.
Yes.
Count seven was for second-degree incidents,
correct,
which were different incidents. than the first-degree incidents.
Correct.
So why wouldn't there not at least be, even if we said, oh, yeah, despite your argument, which I think did not argue for convictions on multiple counts, that those should be, let's assume that. Why should it not be on both of those, since even the multiple count incidents dealt with different incidents? Multiple first degree, multiple second degree.
Well, because if on that issue, if I am remembering the jury instructions correctly, the jury would not have been instructed simply to consider only these two things for the second degree multiple acts charge, if I'm recalling the jury instructions
then
correctly.
We have to
so
get
it's
to
certainly
the jury
possible
instructions of what
that the jury could have thought, well, these were all at least second degree, and so there's no finding that different acts fulfill the second degree multiple acts charge and different acts fulfill the first degree multiple acts charge. But I think that the where you yes, Judge Kirk.
I was just going to say, are you familiar with State versus Reardon?
State versus
Reardon?
I am familiar with the name of the case.
Pardon?
I am not versed on the facts right now, no.
Okay, well, he was the fellow who sexually abused and then murdered his daughter, led the statewide chase, and was then charged with her murder and also multiple acts of first degree criminal sexual conduct, multiple acts of second degree criminal sexual conduct over an extended period of time. The Supreme Court said you can get consecutive sentences for multiple acts of first degree and multiple acts of second degree over time, at least in the facts of that case. Now, he only tried the murder case. He pled straight up on the second and third degree multiple acts, but the court gave consecutive sentences on all three offenses. So why couldn't the court here have just adjudicated on the two counts involving multiple acts, departed, sentenced them consecutively, and got to whatever number he wanted to get to, or she wanted to get to?
Well, the court certainly could have adjudicated on those two charges, chose not to.
I mean, as far as the number would have been limited by 40 years, because I think the max for crim sex was 20 back then. But
right, and so in this case, the court, not that I think it would be appropriate for the court to say this is the number, how am I going to get there, but the court couldn't have gotten even to the number it imposed by doing that, because the statutory maximum for first degree is 360 months. I don't know off the top of my head what it is for second degree, but even doing that, the court couldn't have reached the excessive sentence of 792 that it imposed in this case. I see my time is up. I'm happy to answer any further questions the court has at this time or to answer them on rebuttal.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. Ed Stockmeyer, Assistant Attorney General, appearing for a respondent, the state of Minnesota. I will follow counsel's lead and focus mainly on the single behavioral incident, since that's where the discussion has been this morning. But again, more than happy to answer any questions about any of the other claims. So on the single behavioral incident argument, I want to emphasize what is and is not being argued by appellant. So appellant has not raised a claim that anything was improperly joined. And he hasn't even attempted to fight the precedent that says that multiple discrete sexual assaults prosecuted in a single case can receive multiple sentences. So he's not attacking either really the sentence or the severance ruling per se. The only thing appellant is arguing is that a pretrial severance ruling binds the parties and the court in the completely distinct context of whether to impose multiple sentences at sentencing and a third context of whether additional charges can be added following a mistrial. So the first problem I want to emphasize with appellant's argument is that he does not identify a single instance in Minnesota case law that has indicated that a pretrial ruling with respect to severance binds the post-trial rulings in this manner. The Minnesota Supreme Court and this court have never said that, to my knowledge. But we do have the unpublished cases that we have cited in our brief, which directly address this question of the binding nature of the pretrial severance ruling. And this court has held in at least two unpublished decisions that it is not binding on the post-trial context. So the case law, to the extent there is any on this issue, favors the state. The second problem with appellant's argument is that the consequence of what he's arguing, I think, would actually represent a pretty radical departure from how these sexual assault cases have always been prosecuted in this state. So under appellant's argument, a defendant who is charged with this sort of long-term abuse of a single victim generally can only receive one sentence if the assaulter joined in a single prosecution. Conversely, in order to obtain the multiple sentences that the law authorizes for this kind of conduct, appellant's argument would say the prosecution really has to proceed through serial trials in order to obtain that outcome. And the point I want to emphasize here is I just think that's a radical departure from how we have ever treated these cases.
Counsel, couldn't the state charge a few particular offenses during maybe a particular time period? Maybe it's the closer in time period where the victim actually remembers what days these occurred on and the like, and then go back and charge multiple acts over an extended period of time that ends before those three. Why couldn't the state do that? I've seen that done.
I think there are several ways the state could have organized, maybe you'd call it the units of prosecution in this case. But the case on this, particularly with respect to the multiple acts count, and I refer this court to State versus Suhan, it's cited in our brief, is that the prosecution has discretion on how it wants to organize charges when there are both potential charges for multiple acts over time as well as discrete individual assaults.
Although Suhan dealt with three different multiple acts periods, it didn't deal with multiple acts plus discrete acts. So Suhan, I think, is pretty different.
This probably doesn't matter, but just to clarify, I think it was two multiple acts, and then the third one, which was not sentenced, was a discrete act. So it may not.
But it was not sentenced.
Right.
Okay.
I don't think that was sentenced.
But what I think sort of at issue is, can the state take a period and divide it into two periods, right?
Right. But I think the principle of discretion really applies the same. Because what the appellant was arguing in that case is like, look, if you have multiple counts, all the state can do is just impose one multiple and charge one multiple acts count. And what this court said is no, the prosecution has discretion. And I think that's really what is coming down
Can I just follow up, though, just on that? I guess the argument is, and I think I understand your argument, both parties' arguments about this, but basically I think what the appellant is saying, the state, when you're talking about in this case, there are discrete acts, and those discrete acts are fully comprehended by the multiple acts charges, that the state gets to have its cake and eat it too by adding the multiple count ones in order to create a joint trial. And then later, all right, but don't adjudicate those. And now we're left with like separate behavioral incidents. And whether you put under judicial estoppel or, you know, failure to, I don't know that the state really needed to like challenge that as error and have the district court reverse itself, but that there's something unfair fundamentally about it as the state getting to do that.
Your Honor, I guess I would refer to Suhan because that's basically the argument that we have when we see these cases that are attacking the prosecution's discretion to sort of organize the charges as they want, that it's just fundamentally unfair to let the state sort of try to arrange things to have the most maximal possible outcome. And the courts have said, That's just not part of our doctrine, that the prosecution has discretion. What I would also point to, Your Honor, just in terms of another case in this area, is the Supreme Court's decision in Barthman. Because Barthman was sentenced on two individual sexual assaults. Those were counts one and two. Count three was a multiple act count that encompassed counts one and two. He's not sentenced on count three. And Barfman brought a claim that this exaggerates the criminality of my conduct to the Supreme Court. He also challenged the imposition of sentence on count one and two. The Supreme Court had no problem with what the state did in Barfman. And again, that was multiple discrete sexual assaults in one case with a tagging multiple acts count. And the Supreme there was nothing in the Supreme Court's decision to ever indicate that that was a problem. And so if it wasn't a problem in Barfman, it can't be a problem here because the sort of form of the charges and how they are sentenced is the same here. We have more discrete acts, but the sort of organization and form of how it played out at sentencing is the same as it
was. So Barthman happened to be two discrete acts, but the multiple acts comprehended both of those.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Counsel, couldn't a clever prosecutor, in a situation like, say it was like this, but say the defendant had admitted all his bad behavior, couldn't a creative prosecutor then say, well, I'm going to charge every crime I can get here on an individual complaint, because there's nothing, in fact, the rule suggests you don't file this in a single complaint. I'm going to file a separate complaint for each different date and not try to join them and just try them one after another. Is he going to go to trial when he confessed? Probably not.
So,
but there's nothing to stop a prosecutor from doing that and build this guy's record to maybe 20 or more Crimsex 1 convictions and...
So, Your Honor,
opening the sentencing field dramatically.
I agree with you, and I think that's a problem with appellant's argument. Because if we take appellant's argument to its logical conclusion, that's what will result is we will have these are common cases where a single victim has been abused over time, and in order for the prosecution to preserve its ability to impose multiple sentences, which the law authorizes, what will happen is the prosecution will charge these as discrete assaults, and we will have serialized prosecution. And one point I want to make is I think it would be incredibly ironic if the Supreme Court's case law incorporating 609.035 into the severance context. Again, 609.035, one of the purposes is to prevent serialized prosecution. It would be ironic if the incorporation of that doctrine into the pretrial context would result in prosecutors just charging these serially and just trying a defendant over and over and over in order to get the sentences that the law authorizes. The other problem, of course, and appellant refers to this as a policy argument in his brief, and I guess it is, but I think it's something to be concerned about, is the cruelty that this would impose on victims of this kind of sexual abuse. Victims in these cases will then be forced to testify over and over and over. And I just think that there's no basis in Minnesota case law to treat the pretrial severance and joinder rulings as binding on sentencing in a way that would have that effect. There is no case law that says that's the intention or that's the consequence of the Supreme Court's decision in Profit incorporating the sentencing single behavioral incident rule into the pretrial context. Another point I would like to make just on the consequences of appellant's argument is I'd like to point this court to Profit. Profit cites a case called Dukes. And in Dukes, the Supreme Court said that the state was entitled to charge and try in a single case two homicide offenses that were unrelated. They occurred in a relatively short period of time, but they weren't related by, you know, one was the murder and the other was a part of the attempt to escape. They were just separate murders or attempt, well, I think one was an attempt that occurred in a close period of time against separate victims. The Supreme Court said you can try those together, and I presume that those resulted in multiple sentences because they were different victims. I think it would be odd if that's okay for that single prosecution involving separate victims, separate homicide offenses, and separate offenses. That's okay. But when you have one defendant serially sexually abusing one victim over time, that suddenly that cannot, that either you can only have one sentence imposed or you have to serially prosecute it. I think that's a very odd outcome. That cases like Duke's are okay under appellant's argument, but this case is not. And so, again, I just think that the consequences of adopting appellant's argument are serious. I understand the logic behind his argument. single behavioral incident test applies in both contexts, but I think the fact that it's applying in different contexts should tell us something, that one doesn't bind the other. There will be cases where they should come out slightly differently and different interests are involved. And I think sexual abuse of a child is one of those cases.
But had the judge adjudicated on the multiple acts counts, do you agree that that may have caused a problem to sentence the individual counts?
I don't agree. I think that the judge still had discretion on which way to go, to sentence on the multiple acts or to sentence on the individual counts.
But the multiple acts, you know, means that each charge was an element of that crime.
Right, and
individually another crime? I don't know.
Yeah, Your Honor, my understanding of the case on this, and this is not a claim raised by appellant, so it's unbriefed. I am sort of working from my understanding here, but my understanding is that you sentence on what was the most serious of the offenses. And my understanding of
the multiple acts?
I think that's actually not true. That's what I was getting at. I think they're all at the top of the sex offender guideline. They're both the most severity level letter and the most severity level of sexual offense. I forgot exactly how that grid is structured.
You might be right. I know they've changed the sentencing, but it didn't used to be that way. It used to be it was a higher range for the multiple acts.
That might be, Your Honor, but my understanding is currently they are both, the multiple acts and the individual first-degree sexual assaults, are both as high as they can get. One isn't more serious than the other at that formal level.
Okay.
I would refer, Your Honor, to this was litigated in the first appeal. The parties briefed this issue. I think our brief addresses it head-on, and so I would rely on our arguments there. But again, it's just I am working sort of from my working memory a little bit because it's just not an issue that had been briefed. And, the district court could have done it the way you've describing it. I think the district court could have done it the way that the district court did. The district court has discretion to structure it how it wants. The prosecution has discretion to structure the charges how it wants. And all these cases don't need to come out identically in terms of what gets sentenced and what doesn't.
From my experience, where this really gets confusing, and I shouldn't go off topic, but is when you have a racketeering case, and the question is, do you sentence on just racketeering, or do you sentence on the individual crimes that caused it to be a racket? And oftentimes, especially on drug cases where you're talking major quantity of drugs, and depending on where the judge feels he should assign the range or the number for racketeering, because that's up to the court, and you can go high or low, the racketeering charge actually becomes a lesser sentence than one of the individual crimes that was necessary to establish the racket.
And, Your Honor, I
a lot of litigation that's occurred on that issue, and I don't know if there's case law on it.
Yeah, I don't know either, Your Honor. I have no experience with a case involving the racketeering statute. What I would say is that there are several crimes that have sort of these similar types of aggregation subdivisions. There's one in the theft statute. I think you can think about this criminal sexual conduct multiple acts charge as a type of aggregation statute. And I just don't think you can compare, like, one type of that statute and how it plays out in this context to another. I think they all have their individual features, and we shouldn't generalize about all aggregation crimes in that way.
Yeah, I mean, because in this case, the multiple acts happen to be those discrete acts. In another case, as I think you suggested another time in the argument, you might have a multiple acts that refers to a period of time that you're not sure the date. Right, you could have a different case that has discrete acts plus multiple acts, right? And they're different things, you know? So
correct.
Here we know, and you know, the whole lesser included isn't the crime, the case itself, facts itself, right? It's a legal thing when you look at the element. So it's complicated, I think, like very complicated.
Here
I assume the district court did not, and I'm going over, I recognize that, did not adjudicate the multiple count ones, said they were lesser included. I assume what it meant by that is it's choosing among first degree ones, as your argument would be. It had the choice. I mean, 60904 doesn't permit, in the same course of conduct, multiple violations of the same statute, right? It's like called a lesser included. It's not exactly lesser,
but it's
an included offense. So here it decided apparently that it called it a lesser included offense, and it didn't do that. But you're saying there's nothing that stopped it from choosing the first degree ones that it did, if they're equal.
The, Yeah, I'm not aware of any source of law that says you have to pick the aggregate or you have to pick the discrete. I think it is up to the district court's discretion. As Judge Kirk, one thing you mentioned in counsel's argument, the district court could have done the multiple acts and then done a really high aggravation, maybe double or even greater than double departure. Barthman maybe would have something to say about the greater than double, but you could get to a significant sentence in structuring it different ways. And so that's part of the district court's discretion. And if Your Honor, if I could just make one more point, I know I'm out of time.
No, please.
Very quickly. The other thing I would like to make, is this argument appellant is making about the binding effect of the pretrial ruling was never presented to the district court. And so I think we are, if that's what we're talking about, the error is the failure by the district court to consider its pretrial ruling as binding. I think we're in the realm of plain error because it was not an argument that was presented to the district court. And as I said before, appellant has no authority that talks about the interplay between the post-trial and pre-trial rules in that way. And so I think if it wasn't preserved,
where should they have raised it at sentencing?
At sentencing, Your Honor. Yes.
That the district court that district court clearly erred in concluding that they were the same behavior.
That the district court had already ruled that they were single behavioral incidents and that ruling is binding on the post-trial ruling. Our position in this case is they are not binding. But if I think that's appellant's claim of error, is that they are binding and the district court didn't treat them as binding. And if that's the claim of error, it wasn't an argument that was made, we are in the plain error context.
Okay, so in order to decide that, we would have to look at the sentencing memoranda from trial one and then the absence thereof, the argument at trial three? Because I think trial three, the court basically said, if I recall correctly, that we're going to tell me if there's something different from trial one. Otherwise, don't rebrief all the sentencing.
That's what it said, except for the criminal history.
Except for criminal history, yeah. Right? Okay.
Counsel, right. Just one quick one. What was the defendant's criminal history score before these proceedings led to convictions?
I believe his criminal history, our take, or at least what the district court found, was he was at a 6. And he was a 6 based on his prior convictions.
Okay. He entered the playing field already at the top.
Right. Okay. So he was at that top right-hand corner. He was going to get the maximum he could get no matter what.
And that didn't involve Hernandizing any of the individual
wasn't Hernandized. It was permissive consecutive sentencing. And so on all the others, they dropped down to criminal history score of 0.
Right, yeah. Well, that was my understanding, but I just wanted to make sure that...
No, that's correct, Your Honor.
Correct. Okay.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you. And rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you. A lot to cover here. So with regard to the criminal history score, his criminal history score was not a 6. The court erroneously found it to be a 6. The litigated issue was whether it should be a 6 or a lower score. The evidence that the state presented at the hearing proves that his score was a 4. When this court remands for resentencing, as the state agrees needs to be done in its brief, this court should direct that his score is a 4. That issue was litigated. The evidence is clear. What now, I'd like to do now... Yeah, go ahead.
Counsel, that issue... related to apparently a merger of sentence on two prior convictions, correct?
So one of them, there was a single sentence imposed for two convictions. The other one, there was a sentence imposed on one conviction and no sentence imposed on the other. The district court assigned criminal history points as if he had been sentenced 4 times. He was sentenced twice.
Yeah. But and you're probably correct in that the law requires not only that he be convicted or adjudicated, but also that he be sentenced for it to count.
Correct.
So just adjudicating doesn't give you a point.
Correct. Okay. So moving on to the single behavioral incident, two things I'd like to note about the state's argument before addressing any further questions the court has. One is that the precedent that the state refers to that supposedly supports the state's position is all cases where the opinion gives no indication that there was any pretrial severance motion. So those cases are all different from what we have here, where there was a pretrial finding of single behavioral incident. Certainly there are cases where multiple sentences were imposed in a trial like this. But never in any of the cases that the state cites was there a pretrial finding of single behavioral incident or a severance motion. I'd also like to respond to, the state brought up Dukes, said there's multiple sentences there, it should be here. Dukes, as the state said, there were multiple victims. It's a specific exception to 609.035. In regard to the argument that this court would have to find plain error, it's somewhat ironic because that's an argument the state has never made until 5 minutes ago. So any argument that plain error needs to be shown is waived by being brought up for the first time in oral argument.
Had that question, but we've had a lot of questions. I wondered about whether the standard of review was, and I was going to go back and check the briefs, see what the state said about it. But what does that mean? Like the state forfeits the appropriate standard of review by not briefing it? Is that really an argument that's forfeited and that then therefore we have to assume and apply the standard as if it was objected to?
Well, happily, this court doesn't need to decide that because Mr. Danbury did argue at the district court at the first sentencing hearing, both in his memorandum and in his sentencing argument during the hearing, that because these offenses were joined in a single prosecution, the only count that the court could lawfully sentence was count 5. That argument was made at the district court.
That's not the argument you're making now, though, that it has to be count 5. I don't think you argued that in your brief.
The court needs to impose a sentence on one count, and part of the reason for that is because count 5 allowed all these charges to be joined in a single prosecution, leading to the single behavioral incident finding. That's the reason that the inclusion of that charge is why these offenses were found to be a single behavioral incident. Because of that, the court could only impose sentence on one count. Would it make most sense for that to be count 5? I agree. That's why I think that the way the court has been asking questions about it, whether it's a single behavioral incident or whether count 5 should be deemed to be either the most serious or to encompass all the other charges, I think those are just kind of different ways of stating the same result, which is because count 5 exists, which encompasses all the other behavior, these charges were all tried together. That happened because the court found these to be a single behavioral incident, all encompassed by count 5. And whichever way the court decides is the best way legally to phrase it, the result is the same and the analysis is the same. These charges were all tried together because of count 5. There should be one sentence.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Your case comes down to that, I think, though, essentially judicial estoppel. It decided it once, it's bound by that. I mean, I don't know that there's anything that you cite to that says, apart from that, the court, if it was at sentencing facing discrete acts plus the aggregate one, has to sentence on the aggregate one, absent a prior ruling that's required, unless you're telling me that there is something that requires that now. I don't see you briefing that.
I would say that logically it makes sense that if the court makes a finding these were a single behavioral incident and no one asks for
I'm
that finding
absent,
to be changed,
okay, absent
that, the judicial estoppel argument is certainly that the state should not be allowed to prevail on appeal by asserting now that these offenses were not a single behavioral incident when it convinced the court at the district court to overrule Danbury's objection to the way the trial happened on the basis that they were a single behavioral incident. And of course, I'm happy to answer any further questions the court has about any of the issues.
Anything more? I don't think so. Thank you very much for your arguments. It's a complicated case. I appreciate the excellent briefing and arguments.
Thank you.
Thank you.